I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Why doesn't somebody do something? As we watch tragedies unfold on our TV screens, how often do we ask, why doesn't somebody stop it? In Sudan, one of the biggest countries in Africa, more than a million people have fled their homes to escape a brutal conflict that's already caused the deaths of tens of thousands. The US Congress calls what's happening in the western Darfur region of Sudan genocide. The United Nations calls it the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world. This is a conflict in which both sides are Muslim. The government is said to be backing armed militiamen called the Janjaweed, who terrorize local villagers, slaughter the men, and rape the women. Now, after nearly 18 months of fighting, it looks as if the rest of the world is taking notice. This talk of a multinational African peacekeeping force being deployed, with the first contingents arriving perhaps within the next few days. And the UN Security Council is threatening sanctions against the government unless it does more to end the fighting by the end of this month. This hour we'll be talking about intervention in Sudan. Now that the world agrees it is a crisis, what should be done? Who should intervene? How? What kind of international intervention is likely to improve rather than worsen the conditions in Darfur? And what have we learned from our past mistakes in Africa? You can join our conversation. Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. One of my first guests this hour is from the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. He is El Hassim Wan, who's the deputy head of the African Union's Conflict Management Centre. El Hassim Wan, thank you for joining us on the show today. I want to ask you, first of all, will African Union troops be arriving in Darfur this week?
Well, as you may be aware, we do have a number of observers on the ground. In actual fact, we have 139 personnel on the ground, among them 121 military observers. And among the military observers, you have, of course, observers deployed by the African Union, representatives of the parties, meaning the government of Sudan, the Justice and Equality Movement, the Sudan Liberation Movement, as well as representatives of our partners, including the U.S. and the European Union. We are planning to deploy a protection element of 300 people provided by Nigeria and Rwanda, and our expectation is that the Rwandan contingent of the protection element should be on the ground by the end of this week.
But just to be clear, that deployment will be designed only to protect the observers who are already on the ground. It will not be part of their mission to do anything to seek to end the conflict.
No, well, the observers are there, of course, as part of an agreement that was signed by the government of Sudan and the two rebel movements. The agreement signed in N'Djamena on 8 April, and there was another agreement on the modalities for the monitoring of ceasefire, which was signed in Addis Ababa on 28 May 2004 under the auspices of the African Union. So their presence there is part of the implementation of agreements signed by the parties, and obviously it's contributing to the search for a lasting solution to the crisis that is obtaining on the ground. As far as the protection element is concerned, their main task is, of course, to provide protection to the military observers so that they could conduct their work in a more secure environment. But they have also been given a mandate within the limit of their capacity to provide protection for the civilian population. It means that when they witness an imminent threat to the civilian population and they are in a position to help, then, of course, they will help. They will provide help. But nobody is expecting 300 people to provide protection, you know, to the entire population in a region as large as Darfur.
Well, exactly so. I mean, if I may say so, it is going to take a lot more, is it not, than fine words and 300 troops to help the people of Darfur who have been through the most appalling experience.
Well, indeed, of course, you would need much more troops than that. But I would also like to say that in addition to the efforts done on the military front, what we need to do is more efforts on the political side to ensure that talks resume between the parties to find a lasting solution. No matter how strong is the force you deploy on the ground, the solution has to be political. And we are working on the political front for talks to resume between the parties, and they are due to resume on the 23rd of August in Abuja, Nigeria.
And when you say we, do you mean specifically the African Union? Do you regard this as something which the governments of Africa themselves can deal with, or do you see a role for the broader international community, for the United Nations, for example?
Well, I believe that, and everybody agrees, that AU is better placed to deal with this matter. AU is better placed to deal with this matter. Having said that, it is obvious that we need the support of our partners. We need the support of the UN Security Council. We need the support of the European Union. We need the support of the Arab League. We need the support of all our bilateral partners, including the USA. And indeed, they are already providing help, logistical or financial, to facilitate the work of our observers. And as I indicated earlier, you should bear in mind the fact that among the observers we have on the ground, you do have representatives of the USA and the European Union who are working along with our own military observers to ensure that the ceasefire agreement signed by the parties is adhered to.
Al-Hassim Wan, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us today. Al-Hassim Wan is the deputy head of the African Union's Conflict Management Centre in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Well, let's talk now to Abraham McLaughlin, who is the Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and who has regularly covered the conflict in Darfur. He joins us today on the telephone from Johannesburg. Abraham, this conflict's been going on now for 18 months or so. Is it getting worse? Is it staying the same? Or is it getting better?
I think it's getting slightly better, and I think that's mostly because the world has finally noticed that it happened and that it is happening. The WFP, the World Food Program, which is a UN arm, fed 1 million people in Darfur last month, which is no small undertaking, and they did a lot of it through airdropping out of the back of planes. So there is a lot of international mobilization behind trying to do something about this. Now the question is sort of what to do and how to do it.
Are there fewer attacks now by these Janjaweed militia group on the villages in Darfur?
Yeah, that's hard to tell. I mean, I think it probably has abated a little bit. The attacks, I think, are still going on, and it's more subtle now. The Janjaweed have been incorporated into the police or national army of Sudan, and so by day they're soldiers or policemen, but by night they sort of become Janjaweed again and carry out their madness. So it's perhaps not as regular and open, but it's still happening, but maybe more subtly.
And what's your assessment of how effective or otherwise any kind of African Union military intervention might be?
Well, I was interested in your first guest's response. He didn't go for a full-blown peacekeeping force, and that's what a lot of Westerners are sort of hoping for, because that would mean that the U.S. or Britain or anyone else wouldn't have to send troops, which they abhor the idea of. The hope is that the African Union will sort of pull itself together and get some troops together. The number you hear is 2,000, and they do have troop commitments from Nigeria and South Africa and Rwanda, and the U.S. and others are certainly willing to help with planes and money and all that kind of thing. And so if that can happen, it would be a real boon for the refugees in Darfur and for the African Union. But they've got some things to work through, one of which is that they haven't labeled the crisis in Darfur ethnic cleansing or genocide. So it's hard to know if they're going to send troops if they don't see there's a huge problem.
Abraham, thanks very much indeed for that. Abraham McLaughlin, Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who was talking to us from Johannesburg. Let me now bring in our two guests who are going to be with us for the rest of this hour. Robert Rotberg is here with me in the studio. He's the director of the Belfer Center's Program on Interstate Conflict and Conflict Resolution at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And John Prendergast is a special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group. He joins us from NPR's studios in Washington. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us. Robert Rotberg, is military intervention the answer to Darfur?
Yes, military intervention is critical, as well as all the political changes that are critical. And the military intervention clearly has to come from something more robust than the African Union. There are French troops on the border. The Australians and the Brits have promised to send troops. The issue is to create security in Darfur, move the refugees back, and start planting again.
John Prendergast, I know you were there not very long ago. We heard from El Hassim Wan of the African Union talk of a political solution of negotiations that are due to open later this month. Do you see a political solution?
It's a long way off. We have negotiations a year and a half into this conflict in Darfur. They still haven't sat down across the table, faced each other, and started talking about any of the political issues involved in the conflict. So we're months and months away from probably a fairly substantial outline of an agreement, much less a final agreement.
What everybody seems to be saying to the government in Khartoum is that you must do more to bring these militia men, the Janjaweed, under control to stop their attacks. First question, do you believe the government could do that if it wanted to?
Well, I think that the government controls a substantial slice of the Janjaweed. They have armed them and organized them and fed them and basically allowed them to use barracks and backed up their attacks against villages over the last year and a half. So there is a substantial element that they could rein in immediately if they chose to do that, if there was the political will to do that. There certainly is an element of Janjaweed that are outside of government control that have been sort of organized criminal racketeers for the last 10 years, at least the last 10 years, undertaking fairly large-scale asset stripping of non-Arab villages in the form of livestock raiding. And so that those groups are going to be harder to control, but they're going to melt away if they're confronted with any serious military force.
Okay, the other question then, I suppose, is what is this conflict really all about? I guess there is no easy answer, but who wants what out of this?
Well, on the one hand, you have issues, fundamental political issues, economic and political and social marginalization that's felt by communities in Darfur that have been left out of sort of the political pie, the slicing of the political pie in Khartoum. So those kind of traditional issues. But there are also issues of land tenure and access to grazing and water that over decades now has come to a head and pitted communities against each other. And basically Khartoum, the Khartoum government, by taking sides, by supporting the Arab militias against the groups that had risen up against the government, by taking sides, giving those militias total impunity and arming them and backing up their attacks, they have been, in a sense, accomplices to what is at least an ethnic cleansing, if not genocide. And so I think that the game has changed completely. It's not really a traditional conflict in a normal sense. The bar has risen to the point of accusations of genocide, and that requires a very different response.
And Robert Rotberg, if that response is to be a military one, if you have little faith that it can be done by political negotiation alone, is there really no chance of saying this is a conflict in Africa, on the continent of Africa, it requires an African solution?
I wish that were the case. An African solution is always best, but it's not clear that the Africans can put the muscle on Khartoum, where the issue really lies. It's not clear that the Abuja negotiations will occur, or if they occur, will actually result in much. So the answer is really military intervention.
We're going to take a break. We're talking about Darfur and who, if anyone, should intervene. You can call 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Robin Lustig in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about intervention in Darfur in Sudan. Do you think international pressure could help to ease the tragedy, or do you worry that intervention might do more harm than good? Join our conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And first up is Radam, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Radam, hello.
Hello.
What do you think about this?
Thank you for giving me a chance.
Sure.
I'm thinking, you know, I have a question from the guy from Ethiopia. Why Africa Union it take a long time to enter this problem? Because I'm assuming, you know, they know this problem a long time ago. Why they don't make a solution with the Sudanese government before international people intervene or see as a problem?
You think it's taken them too long to wake up, do you?
Yeah, I'm thinking that Africa Union, because this is Africa problem, they have to take first us as a problem and before international people intervene.
Okay, John Prendergast, what do you think's the answer?
Well, I think the African Union is trying to reinvent itself now. For years, we knew it as the Organization of African Unity, and in the last couple of years, it decided to reorganize under a new name and create a more active, more proactive organization on the African continent to deal with problems. So we're at this sort of incipient stage of Africa's attempt to get its act together, and I think that that's why we've seen, partially why we've seen it take so long to respond to this problem. But secondly, it is a problem of respect for each other's sovereignty. I think this is also the problem that this United Nations Security Council is facing, that sovereignty, despite all the rhetoric and speeches that people make about the importance of intervening, the importance of taking responsibility when governments have abdicated that responsibility to protect civilians, I think still sovereignty and respect for a country's borders will trump intervention nearly every time, and especially in Africa, which is marginally important to international strategic concerns, I think you're not going to get much of a bounce in terms of efforts on the part of the world to try to intervene and break through the sovereign status of the government of Sudan and jump over that to do something specifically in defense of the people of Darfur.
And Robert Rotberg, there is always a problem, isn't there, with any kind of conflict within the borders of a single state, which is that other governments in the region tend, by and large, to have sympathy with the government, which always says it's facing a rebellion and will deal with it in its own way.
Governments always have a sympathy with the other government. Governments in Africa fear that the intervention that they sanction in the Sudan would be used against them, obviously. The UN has that same problem. John's right, the African Union is new, but the African Union has this golden opportunity to show what it's made of. But at the moment, with only the ability to muster 300 troops when they need thousands, doesn't show much for the willingness of most African nations to take a strong role.
John, we talk about the Janjaweed militia, who are causing such a huge degree of casualties and of suffering. There are also, though, rebel groups in the area, aren't there, who, against whom, in theory, these militias are fighting?
No, I think that that's a major misconception, and unfortunately the United Nations is feeding that misconception. What we have is a government fighting a rebel group. The government has subcontracted these militias called the Janjaweed to fight on its behalf. The war is between the rebel group and the government, and what the United Nations, what the government would like everyone to believe is that it's between the rebels and these militias to try to make it a localized conflict in a case where it is not. So I think we really have to maintain that and stop equating the disarmament of the rebels with the disarmament of the Janjaweed. Rather, there has to be a political solution that deals with the grievances that are felt by the people of Darfur and all of the atrocities that have occurred over the last year and a half as a result of the government's arming of the Janjaweed and allowing the militias to attack with such ferocity.
And can I just clarify one thing with you? Many listeners will recall that there was for many years, for decades indeed, a conflict in the south of the country between people in southern Sudan and the government in the north. This conflict that we're talking about now, the conflict in Darfur, is separate or somehow related?
Yeah, what we have is a situation where the center of the country, a small group of people in the center, as represented by this current regime, which took power, by the way, in a military coup and has very little public support nationally. It's a war between that small clique of people and a number of regions throughout the country, and it manifests itself in specific wars via specific rebel groups. And in the southern part of the country, the southern-based rebellion, the SPLA, is the largest rebellion, and that's the one that's gone on for at least two decades and in which 2 million people have died. The Darfur, the western part of the country, the Darfur conflict has only erupted over the last year and a half in earnest, And it is responsible at this point for about maybe 50 to 80,000 deaths. But that number is likely to increase very, very sharply in the coming months as the waterborne diseases from the rainy season take hold in the internally displaced camps where most people are now.
There's one other piece of information I'd like from you. We have these militias described as Arab militias. Is that an ethnic designation or is that a linguistic designation?
It's both. They're self-identification principally. I think all these people come from various groups, lineages that are very interrelated. There's been a lot of intercommunal marriage and mixing over the years. And like in Rwanda and Burundi, when you go back centuries, you find very, very common heritages. So, however, people very, very strongly identify themselves in Darfur as Arab and non-Arab. And the groups that have been targeted by the government in this conflict have been particularly three non-Arab groups, the Zagawa and the Fur and the Masalit. And these are the groups that have suffered most of the attacks and the atrocities at the hands of these forces. So it has become very solidified, these ethnic identity, self-identification. And I think that at the end of the day is what matters, not how we sort of figure who's white, who's black, who's light-skinned and all the rest of that. It really means nothing there. People have very specific beliefs about who they are and what their history is.
Robert Rotberg, you said a moment ago that you thought it would be preferable if an African solution to this conflict could be found, but that you doubted that it could in current circumstances. Who decides who takes responsibility for trying to deal with an event of this kind?
Well, basically, the UN must, at the end of the day, decide who intervenes. There's a responsibility to protect citizens at risk. There are, as John has described, a million citizens or more at risk. The war will go on. The war goes, as Abe discussed, at night as well as by day now. So the UN does have that responsibility, and the strongest powers, the US, the UK, and so on, need to exercise that responsibility to protect.
Hans is on the line from Salem in Massachusetts. Hans, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, it's more of a question.
Okay.
The fact, you know, we didn't respect the sovereignty of Iraq and went in, and one of the arguments to go in was human rights, that, you know, Saddam was this horrible man, and the fact that we, I guess, are respecting the sovereignty of Sudan and not going in. What does the international community, or other countries think? Do they think does this make us look like we just went into Iraq for oil? You know, they think, you know, should we go in if we're going to respect the human rights of one country, try to help the human rights of another country?
Okay, Hans, let's get Robert Rotberg's answer to that. Why Iraq? Why not Sudan?
Why not Sudan? The question is, we should be in Sudan, and clearly there was a humanitarian crisis. There's an ongoing one. We should be in a dozen countries where there are serious humanitarian crises, and Iraq might have been one, but not the only one. So I think the questioner rightly points to the disparities between an Iraqi case and a Sudanese, a Zimbabwe, a Turkmenistan case, and many, many others.
The reality, presumably, is that governments make decisions based on what they perceive to be their national interest.
Well, and the national interest sometimes doesn't take account, as it should, of the responsibility to look after the unfortunate, the ethnically cleansed, subject to the dangers that, as we have seen in the Western Sudan.
Do you believe, though, that it is possible to say that in the current international environment in which we find ourselves, nations like the US, other major Western powers, ought to intervene militarily every time they perceive a humanitarian disaster?
I think every time is too strong, but certainly in key cases like Darfur, with a minimal use of force, that is, we're only talking about a few thousand troops, unlike 140,000 in Iraq, wonders could be done. People could be saved. We need to clearly you use a political pressure on Khartoum as well as the thought of a military intervention.
John Prendergast, is it true that were such an international force to be deployed, the government in Khartoum would object to it and seek to resist it?
Well, in the first instance, of course it will, and it already has made clear that it is opposed to any deployment of peacekeeping forces. It certainly accepts the these 300 soldiers that will come in over the next few weeks, as Mr. Wan outlined to you earlier. And your question was absolutely right. You know, this is, of course, grossly inadequate to the task. And as long as Khartoum isn't being pressured to accept these forces, a larger number of forces, and an intervention of the kind that Bob is talking about, the killings and the atrocities will continue in Darfur.
So it would be more in the nature of a war-making force rather than a peacekeeping force?
Well, I don't think so. I think what is being proposed at this point is a very reasonable proposition, and that is that the African Union would put around three brigades together, which would be roughly 3,000 troops. They would go in and they would protect civilians. This wouldn't be an intervention force that aims for regime change. It would be an intervention force that aims to protect people in these displaced camps from the attacks of the Janjaweed militias. And if the government is continuing its attacks, which it is, they would also block those. And so that is, in effect, what is being proposed. And the government has rejected that now over the last few days. But it hasn't yet been the subject, this deployment, of more assertive diplomacy by the United States and the European Union to say we demand that this force be deployed in order to, as Bob says, protect the civilian population, which is continuing to be attacked. So I think that that's really the first line of defense that needs to be deployed. Now, if the government says, no way, we're never going to accept that, then we got to go up the next level and start to talk about UN Security Council authorized or NATO deployments or European Union deployments. There are a number of models that are out there that would be looked at. Unfortunately, those will take months to put together, given the political will right now in Europe and the United States for doing something like that. So we need to use the model that exists out there, the African model, to get those forces on the ground and protecting people immediately.
But John's absolutely right, but it's too slow, as John would agree. I'm sure we need to get troops in there soon, and the French are on the border.
Yeah, and Bob, that's a very, you know, it's so fascinating. For weeks, Secretary Powell and others have been saying that the U.S. is leading this thing where we're the only country that's doing anything, the French and everybody else is not doing a thing. Well, the French deployed its forces to the border in the matter of hours. If we had the will to put the logistical supply line in place for these African forces, if we had the will to undertake the very assertive diplomacy and the very real building of leverage with the government to force it to accept that deployment, I think we could make a very, very rapid difference in the lives of the people out there.
Let's take another call. Luai is on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. Luai, hello.
Hi, and hi to your guests. I worked in Darfur 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and, you know, we were dealing with this crisis then. Unfortunately, your guests are dealing with only the superficial, if I could use that term, aspect, or the recent violence, which in my opinion should be dealt with by an African force separating the two sides. The central problem with Darfur has been the enormous climate change and creeping desertification, which has taken place since the mid-1970s. And this has led the two main groups living there. We got to discard these labels of Arab and African. These two groups, one of whom is nomadic and one of whom are farmers, to both not have access or the ability to grow their foods. The nomads have taken arms as to keep their herds alive in the face of this climatic catastrophe. So even if we could separate the two sides now, even if we could stop the killing, unless we solve the basic ability of these people to continue their lives, feed their herds, and continue farming in that area, Darfur cannot be solved. Outside intervention is a panacea, which is very short-term. It will not lead to a solution.
Luai, thanks very much indeed for that. It's an interesting new element. Robert Rotberg, if climate change, if desertification is, at least in part, what's responsible for this, military intervention can't be the solution.
No, but it has to be to stabilize the situation in the short term. Your caller is right about the long term, but the short term is very important because we've got to get the refugees back. They're in terrible conditions. We need to separate the grazers from the growers. We need to allow the growers to grow. We need to allow the grazers to graze in peace. So the issue, before we can do relief, we have to have a security in the area. Otherwise, as John says, more and more people are going to die.
John Prendergast, do you see some justification in what Luai was saying there?
Well, sure. I mean, the desertification is a major factor, and as part and parcel of the peace process, land tenure, you know, making sure that the populations, the pastoral populations, have grazing rights will be a factor, and codifying those grazing rights will be part of the solution. But this war is about power in Sudan. This is about an autocratic regime that will do anything, use any means necessary to maintain power. And when we saw a few groups in Western Sudan rise up against it in early 2003, what resulted has been a major ethnic cleansing. There is no comparison between the famine relief effort that this gentleman was involved in 20 years ago, which was largely in response to a major drought driven by desertification, and the current genocidal activity that we're seeing now.
How relevant is it, do you think, that the government in Khartoum is also one which, since 9/11, is said by Washington to have offered a certain degree of assistance in what we call the war on terror? Might that also be coloring U.S. and Western policy?
Well, I think it is. I think that the United States, since the Bush administration assumed office, and particularly after September 11, has pursued a policy of constructive engagement with this regime, and we pursued negotiations with it with respect to the southern-based war that we talked about earlier, at the same time as this huge ethnic cleansing was unfolding in Darfur, and we did nothing about it.
We'll take a break. You can join our conversation. We're talking about the crisis in Darfur in Sudan. The world seems to have woken up, but now what? That's the question we are discussing. We'll take your questions. Just call 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Robin Lustig, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. My guests this hour, Robert Rotberg from Harvard University and John Prendergast from the International Crisis Group. What we're talking about is the crisis in Darfur, in Sudan, and the prospect of some kind of intervention there. We welcome your calls. Join us on 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Line 1, Zaudi is calling from Portsmouth in Virginia. Hi, Zaudi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yeah. My comment is, I just wonder, why are we waiting? First of all, the Arab countries, they didn't even solve their own problem. They should stay away from there. And this is a United Nations problem, and the United Nations should give them a sanction. What are we waiting to see? Why are we even give them 3 weeks?
Okay.
They need to be sanctioned, and that's the only way they could find the solution.
Okay, thanks, Zaudi. Robert Rotberg, why are we waiting? We do now have the African Union saying it's trying to do something. We also have the Arab League saying don't impose sanctions, it'll make things worse rather than better. Why has it taken so long?
Well, it's taken so long because the world only woke up very slowly, much too slowly, to the problem. The Arab League is now saying hold off, which is a delaying tactic in solidarity with the Khartoum government. And as John says, the political will isn't in Khartoum yet. And what the caller says is quite right. We need to put greater pressure on the government of the Sudan to do what they should have done a long time ago.
John Prendergast, many listeners will remember the appalling events of Rwanda a decade ago. Was no lesson learnt then about the dangers of not acting more quickly?
Well, I think a lot of lessons are learned, but the will, I mean, again, to go back to what Bob says, if political will is not there, you know, you're not going to get a response. And so we've watched Sudan unfold as almost a Rwanda in slow motion over 16 months. I mean, just imagine in Rwanda, it took 90 days to kill 800,000 people. Well, the U.S. government, especially the foreign policy establishment in the U.S. government, is simply incapable of doing anything in 90 days. It takes a long time for them to get organized. And so now, in the case of Sudan, and particularly with respect to Rwanda, nobody even knew where it was. But it, with respect to Sudan, this has been a major investment of the United States government's time and energy over the last 3 years in trying to resolve this war in the south. So it really is a remarkable thing that over a 16-month period, as your caller just pointed out, and I think she ought to be the next Secretary General of the United Nations, by the way, but I think that we need to act now and then say, by introducing the concepts of sanctions and accountability and other things, and then say to the government, okay, if you comply with what we've asked you to do now for months and months and months, then we'll remove these sanctions, rather than threatening that we're going to introduce them and never doing so.
We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
For the last couple years, in fact, probably about 3 years, I've been hearing a lot about the North Sudan's persecution of the Christians in the South. By the same token, but despite being a Democrat and a strong supporter of President Clinton, I was a little disturbed at Madeleine Albright saying that the situation with the persecution in the South was not marketable to the American people. I'd kind of like to know, in your opinion, what some of the comparisons are between the situation of the North persecuting the South and the situation in Darfur.
John?
Well, I think in Darfur, it's important to note that every single one of the victims, whether the ones that are dead or the ones that have been penned up in these internally displaced camps, the women that have been gang raped, all of them are Muslim. This, again, is a conflict that is about power. Both the conflict in the South, the conflict in the West, this government is going to do anything it can to keep power. In fact, it did and it has persecuted Christians as one of many groups that it perceives as hostile to its interests. It has forcibly Islamicized groups and proselytized groups using food and other means to ensure that people will convert. So it's done all these things in the South and in the central part of the country and continues to do it in certain parts of the country that are outside of the radar screen of the government of the international community. And this is what really, I think, has promoted or earned the ire of the U.S. Congress and other groups around the United States who have become very, very active on the foreign policy question of Sudan in a way that they normally aren't exercised about issues. People believe that the Sudan is one of the worst abusers of religious freedoms in the world, and they will act upon that in defense of people that they believe are being discriminated against.
Robert Rotberg, it's about power, it's about access to land, as we have already discussed. Are there resources available in this part of Sudan as well, which are going to be of interest to different groups?
There's a suspicion that there's reservoirs of oil in the south of Darfur. Aha, yes. Clearly, this is about power. It's about the southern-northern war spreading to Darfur. So the proxy war aspect is there for sure. But there's suspicions of oil, and the main war, the Sudanese North-South War, has always been about oil in large part. So oil once again comes to the surface, and whether it's oil or gas, it's still supplies of something the Sudanese doesn't have much of.
In many different African nations, governments are terrified that borders that were drawn by colonial powers, by the British or by others, may not be holdable indefinitely. Is Sudan one of those countries where a government of whatever political complexion fears the breakup, the loss of the country as currently bordered?
Yes, but it has nothing to do with the colonial borders. Clearly, the Sudan as constituted a long time ago, in the 19th as well as the last century and a bit, depends on holding it together, but mostly because there might be resources under both sides in the case of North-South and in Darfur in the South.
So, John, if one looks at examples elsewhere in Africa, and I'm thinking perhaps particularly of what used to be Zaire, what's now called the Democratic Republic of Congo, lots of resources, very valuable resources there, which different groups have been fighting over for a great period of time. Can international intervention solve that kind of conflict?
Well, I think it's part of the equation. And in fact, the part is in the way that Bob mentioned earlier. It's in stabilizing situations, reducing the human rights catastrophes and preventing their acceleration, and providing a sense of security for the civilian populations. And a stoppage of the active forms of conflict so that political negotiations can commence to address the longer term issues. And that combination of things, that stabilization and then conflict resolution effort, is one that has to be a partnership between African states and organizations, as well with the United States and the European Union and other willing countries around the world. I think with that kind of a partnership, we can make a difference in Africa.
Okay, we'll go to Abdul, who's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hello, Abdul.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling to. I'm actually from that area.
From Darfur.
Right.
Uh huh.
See, and I don't think the intervention of international forces is a good idea, and even this war is being like portrayed in a different way, like Arabs and Africans. And that's not the truth. You see, like, you have many different tribes, like Zakawa and Masalit and Four, all together living together, and you have those nomads. You find the same tribes, sometimes nomads, and sometimes they are farmers, and all of them, like, together. Whoever is a nomad, they call him Arab. That's the thing. That's the word for it.
Abdul, do you still have family in the region?
Right, yeah, I do.
What do you hear from them?
Right, I heard from them like a couple of weeks ago, and they said that they had troubles in their village. But you see, not only these Janjaweed are doing this. The other rebels also are attacking villages. They last week when I called, they said they came there and they took the judge of that city. It's called Al-Ayyid Jarlabi, and they said they held him, and then when I called again, they told me that they tried to loot. And you see, this is not the Janjaweed. This is what they call themselves, like different names for rebels. You have got like 5-6 groups of rebels.
Okay, so Abdul, you say that you do not believe that international intervention is the solution. What would be your preferred way of dealing with this problem?
The preferred way is to leave it to the African Union and Sudan. I know Sudan government. I am against this government, and I was here some time ago for like political reasons because I disagree with this government. I don't agree with it totally, but I think this problem is because of there was a fraction in that governing body, some people like a Turabi people and the other people like they come from the north, they have split. So those are Turabi people, mainly they came from the west. So there was a fighting going on for decades, as long as I remember. Because if you are nomad, you're gonna go through some farms and then somebody will not like this idea, then you get in clashes. That has been going on for a long time.
So even when you were growing up in Darfur, right, there was conflict, was there?
Right, yeah, but it is not as big. And the weapons are there because there was war in Chad sometime back, and everybody can get weapons there.
Okay. Abdul, thank you very much indeed for that. Robert, there you have a guy with family from Darfur still there. He grew up there, and he says, leave it to the African Union.
Well, you can't just leave it to the African Union because, as we said at the beginning of the program, the African Union isn't swift enough, isn't yet strong enough. It's new. It doesn't have its wherewithal in place. The Nigerians and the Rwandans will be hard-pressed to get the troops there. And then the question is, what is their mandate? And if they have a robust mandate, it'll be less robust than French or Australians and so on.
John Prendergast, let's just look ahead for the rest of this month. The deadline that was set by the UN Security Council was the end of August. Unless real progress has been made by then, the threat of sanctions hangs over the head of the government in Khartoum. Is it your belief that sanctions will, in fact, be imposed?
Well, a remarkable thing happened 4 or 5 days after the Security Council voted a very, very weak resolution, whose only operative actual clause is to impose an arms embargo on non-governmental actors in Darfur, which would include the rebels, of course, the only group that is in fact protecting civilians as we speak. So the Security Council basically punted down the road for 30 days. But even as it punted, in the middle of as the ball was in the air, the Secretary General sent out his special envoy to negotiate a deal with the government that gave it even more time, and the Secretary General's special envoy announced that, you know what, it's probably not going to be possible for the government to comply with this 30-day, with all the things it's supposed to do in the next 30 days. So let's give it a little bit of a break. I mean, the UN's effort on this catastrophe has been absolutely horrific, and we keep undercutting ourselves. But so will sanctions be imposed by the end of August? No.
Robert Rotberg, it sounds then as if we're looking at a very slow-moving, long-drawn-out game of diplomatic patball, and nothing's going to be done?
Well, unfortunately, if that's true, and it might be, we will lose the opportunity to show that our impulses, U.S. and the Security Council impulses, are the right ones. We need, as I keep saying, to move more rapidly. John may be right, but the sanctions need to be imposed of some kind. But basically, the U.S. itself has leverage on the Khartoum government. The Khartoum government desperately needs the U.S. to be more friendly to it. It needs investors and so on. So there is more leverage that the U.S. can exert.
And the U.S. has to be the lead actor.
As always, unfortunately.
My thanks to my guests, Robert Rotberg, director of the Belfer Center's program on interstate conflict and conflict resolution at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, John Prendergast, special advisor at the International Crisis Group. We also spoke earlier in the program to El-Hassim Wan, deputy head of the African Union's Conflict Management Center, and to Abraham McLaughlin, Africa correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Robin Lustig. This is The Connection.